The human rights that are mostly relevant to companies, the main one and most important one is Article 1, Protocol 1, which is the right to peaceful enjoyment of possessions. I'll just wait till the chairs come in.
Charles
didn't actually have anything that was something that could be handed round.
Okay.
Do you mind just pushing the door closed? I'm going to stand up just because I've been sitting down all day. The main human rights that are relevant to companies are firstly Article 1, Protocol 1, secondly Article 6, and thirdly Article 10. And I'm going to concentrate on Article 1, Protocol 1 because it's firstly it's the most important one. It's the one with the most recent developments, but also it's the one that if you're looking to get damages for a company, then that's the one really that you need. You can get damages under the others, but they're very limited. I'm going to look at first Article 1, Protocol 1, in quite a lot of detail, then touch upon Article 6 and later 10, and then look at some remedies points. What you do have there is a piece of paper with Article 1, Protocol 1 on it, and this is actually from the European Convention on Human Rights, which I'm sure you've all got stuck up on the wall next to your bed. Article 1, Protocol 1 is worth looking at. For those of you familiar with some of the other human rights, it's a weird one. The normal setup of human rights that we're used to, or at least those rights which are justified, is you first of all define the interference, take Article 8, the right to private life. And then in the second paragraph, you have the usual stuff. It's only lawful if necessary for the achievement of the legitimate aim, which are ABC, and then it has to be in accordance with the law, and so on. Article 1 is phrased differently to that. And as you can see here, it says as follows: every natural or legal person is entitled to the peaceful enjoyment of his possessions. No one should be deprived of his possessions except in public interest and subject to the conditions provided for by the law and by the general principles of international law. The preceding provision shall not, however, in any way impair the right of states to enforce such laws as it deems necessary to control the use of property in accordance with the general interest or to secure the payment of taxes or other contributions or penalties. I'll come back to look at that in a bit more detail in a minute. But the good news for everyone who's used to other human rights cases is that the courts touch upon that now and then, pay lip service to it, and then ignore it, and just apply the principles that you're completely used to in other cases. So all of the standard things, you look at the interference, and then you look at whether there's a legitimate aim, justification, and so on. Just ignore this, you can just apply the usual principles. So that's the article. The first thing to think about then is what is a possession? So what does the right protect? Possessions are basically property. It is the two phrases to remember when you think about possession is either something that you have, the person or company or body has a legal entitlement to an economic benefit. That's the starting point for it. But it's not only things that you actually have a right to now, there's also a concept of legitimate expectation. So if you can show you have a legitimate expectation to an entitlement at some point in the future, then that is also a possession. Important to remember though, legitimate expectation in this context means something different to what we know very well it means in the public law context. So public law includes things like promises, clear and unambiguous promises by a public authority or other. That's not enough for Article 1. You have to show that there was some legal act, so a statute, a court decision, something that can be defined as a legal act, which entitles you to a benefit at some point in the future. And I'll come back to what that means with a couple of examples in a minute. But one thing that it's not, one thing that a possession is not, is an expectation of future income. This is a classic sort of article where the courts, the European court looks at a few cases and says, ah yes, this is a very important principle, we put down this principle, and then it has three or four different principles, and then no real analysis about the overlap in the middle, and a real lack of clear boundaries. So if you think about the legitimate expectation for a moment, an example done that we're going to come at later is a case called Infinix, which is a really important case in this context. It's about renewable obligation certificates. which is essentially something that it's a power company that's the claimant in that case. And it was saying that our energy is renewable, so we are therefore entitled to this certificate, the renewable obligation certificate, it's very difficult to say, which companies are entitled to if certain statutory conditions are met. And the company was saying we're entitled to that because we've met these conditions, therefore we should have a certificate. And if the company is given a certificate, then every megawatt hour of electricity they produce, which satisfies the renewable conditions later on, they then receive a subsidy for. And so Infinis was saying that we should have been given the certificate, and that entitled us to this future benefit, this subsidy from later producing the right kind of power. And the courts essentially found that that was a possession. So the future income from this power was a possession. It's very difficult to understand what the difference between that and just loss of future income is. I mean, once you get beneath the surface, you can begin to do so. But the boundaries between these different definitions are, as usual, a little unclear. So a couple of examples then. That's Infinis. Other examples are obvious things, and the cases that will come to you later are things like aeroplanes. Someone owns an aeroplane, that's their possession. Less obvious ones, licenses can amount to a possession. And there's an example of a license which does amount to a possession. There's a case called Tre Trattoria against Sweden. That's sort of one of the five or six cases you really need to know about in this context. And Tre Trattoria involved a liquor license. So it's a restaurant which was owned by a company, and the company had obtained a liquor license, so it can sell alcohol in its restaurant. But the license wasn't transferable, and the question was whether that sort of something you couldn't sell, simply a license which enabled you again to gain income in the future after it had been granted, does that amount to a possession? The court decided yes, it does in that particular context. And the main reason for that, and this is another key phrase to remember, is the capitalised or marketable value of the business. If the licence itself, even if it's not transferable, is something that increases the value of the business, then that's something that amounts to a possession. Whereas if you had a licence and you didn't have enough evidence to come forward, and there's been a number of cases in this field in England, where there have been real problems in companies coming forward and not having the evidence to show that there's this increase in value of the business effectively by the license. If you can't prove that, then you're in trouble. So that's licenses. Other things that can amount to possessions, client base, a doctor or a lawyer's client base, people who are going to consistently come back to you, that can amount to a possession, but whether it does or not, again, a bit like licenses, is a very difficult question. But the possibility that it does means that, therefore, Article 1, Protocol 1 can be brought into effect in areas like regulation. Doctors, lawyers, financial regulation, that sort of thing. It might be relevant in that situation. Who can benefit from it? So who can claim as a victim of this of the breach of Article 1, Protocol 1? Anyone entitled to the property, essentially. So any individual that has a legal right to the property, any company, an association of individuals can do, providing that is representative of their members. So it's a very broad range of people or companies or legal persons. The next question is, what is an interference? And this takes us back to the text of the article. If you can have a look at that again and just see that the way that this is phrased. The court sometimes categorise what an interference is into three different categories, and this is pretty much taken from the text of the article that you can see there. The first category is a deprivation of a possession. So you lose the possession entirely. That's pretty obvious. The meaning of that is pretty clear. The The other two categories are slightly less clear. The second one is an interference, and that's brought from the first sentence of Article 1, Protocol 1. Every natural or legal person is entitled to peaceful enjoyment of his possessions. So something which isn't a complete deprivation of the possession, but is still an interference with it. Something like water flowing onto your land, nuisance, a loan, or temporary loss of the product, things like that. That can be an interference. The third category is even odder, though, and this comes from the second paragraph of Article 1. It's the control of use. So as you can see in the second paragraph there, the state is entitled to enforce such laws as it deems necessary to control the use of property, whether that's in the general interest or for the purposes of tax. And so the courts sometimes latch onto that and say, in control of use cases, there are particular principles that have to be applied. In reality, as you may expect, although the court pays lip service against those three categories, in reality it's just the normal principles that you would expect that are actually applied to it. So really, how serious is the breach? That's the main question. And a deprivation is more serious than an interference. Has the state enacted legislation to allow the interference? If it has, it's much more difficult for you to establish liability. And so really, I think it's much easier to think of these just in the normal categories that you're using, applying the normal principles that you're used to from other human rights work. The next question then, after you have decided whether or not there's an interference, is to go and look at whether the interference is lawful, standard approach. And although the words that you see in some of the other articles don't appear on the face of Article 1, Protocol 1, so in accordance with the law, legitimate aim, that sort of thing, again, the courts have just said these principles are really inherent in all of human rights, and they apply to Article 1, Protocol 1 just as much as everything else. So, to be lawful, the interference firstly has to be in accordance with the law. And we know the normal definition of that. It includes that the law must be foreseeable, it has to be accessible, and it can't be arbitrary. Now, a couple of tips when you're looking at these cases, especially in the commercial context. Firstly, on the plus side, in the commercial context, the courts, as you would probably expect, give a greater margin of appreciation to the states to interfere with rights. So the Human Rights Act is really, in the European Convention, is really aimed primarily at fundamental rights, torture, life, liberty, that sort of thing. Interference with property, especially if it's a risk-taking business like a company, the courts have their sympathy with it. But that doesn't mean they don't have any sympathy, and there are still a lot of cases where there have been breaches and a lot of cases where damages have been provided. But you are on better ground if you're not simply arguing about proportionality with these cases. So if you can show something like inconsistency or arbitrariness, or something like that, which isn't just that the authorities or the court have got the balance wrong, then you're on much stronger ground. And I'll come to a couple of examples to try and illustrate that later on. So that's in accordance with the law. The other point about that actually is, again, another point about companies. This aspect of in accordance with the law, accessibility, I'm sure you may have come across that in Article 8 cases, where the law must be accessible, available, and sufficiently clear to normal members of the public. That has a slightly different meaning when it comes to a company, because companies are expected to have greater expertise often. It obviously depends on who the company is. But if you're a big and very well-resourced company, then you may well be expected to instruct experts to tell you what the law is, and the courts will therefore have less sympathy with you. If you don't know what the law is, but you should be able to, basically, you can be by instructing experts. So that's in accordance with the law. The next question is proportionality, and I've touched upon that. In some cases, especially where the breach is more serious, to be proportionate, it has the interference. Measure must also be necessary in order to achieve the legitimate aim. That is, there must be no less interfering alternative In the context of companies, though, that the necessity requirement is not often relevant. If the breach is serious enough, then it may come into it. But often, the necessity principle is most important. What, of course, fall back on is this much vaguer one, the fair balance between the needs of the individual and the community as a whole. And that is a slightly harder test to satisfy. One of the cases you may be familiar with in this area is the one of Markic and Thames Water. And this was someone whose property was near to Thames Water facility, and their property kept getting flooded really nastily with sewage, really covered with sewage. And one of the questions for the court was whether that interference was proportionate. And so the fair balance concept came into effect. And the courts were considering whether one person having their property completely submerged by sewage regularly was a fair balance with the needs of consumers generally to pay what extra money they had to pay in order to stop that happening. And somewhat surprisingly, the courts found that it was. It's difficult to think why, but it's worth actually, you have to look a bit closer at the facts of that case to understand why they came to that conclusion. The main reason they came to that was that there was a very strict scheme in place which gave responsibility for deciding the proportionality question to a particular body. And the claimant in that case hadn't complained to that body, and so there'd been no determination by the responsible body as to whether this was proportionate. And so really in that case what the courts were saying was it's not our job, it's someone else's. But anyway, it's still not a completely unusual example. Courts are a little bit harsher in this area than in others. So, the last aspect of lawfulness that the courts have brought in from other areas into A1, P1, is procedure. The courts have decided that it's implicit within A1, P1, that there's a minimum level of procedural fairness that's necessary before there can be an interference. So the same as with other articles. It depends on the level of interference what procedure is necessary. But an example of it is a banking case that we'll come to later, where a bank's license was withdrawn. And the bank was given no opportunity to make representations beforehand and had no opportunity to judicially review the decision afterwards. And so the court said, well, that's procedurally unfair, you're not allowed to interfere unless you're going to go through that procedure. So it's worth thinking about procedure as well in this context. I'm just checking time, see what's happening. Okay, there were a few more things about A1, P1, about compensation, and that if there is going to be a deprivation of your rights under this article, then if it's a complete deprivation, you normally have to be compensated for it. The level of compensation is a matter for the state. So even if it seems really low, then you're in trouble challenging that. But as long as there's some compensation, then that's okay. If there's no compensation for deprivation, then that's probably unlawful in most situations. So perhaps you can turn then, please, to the seminar notes that I've got that I've produced. There's a pile of them in the middle of the table. And I'm on a bit more familiar ground now. I actually have prepared for this part of it. This is more concentrating on quantum first, on Article 1, Protocol 1. And then we're going to move on and have a look at expert evidence procedure and things like that. So the basic principles then for quantum. I'm afraid I wasn't here in earlier sessions today, so you may already have had these, but it's worth repeating them. The three basic principles that apply here, as they do in other Human Rights Act damages claims, are as follows. Firstly, there's Section 83 of the Human Rights Act, which is that the court may award damages if the award is necessary to afford just satisfaction to the claimant, a sort of necessarily vague test. The second principle is one that really the key case on this now is Faulkner, which was a Supreme Court case in a completely different context, parole board context, that happened last year. But it is that the courts look to see if there's any discernible principle from Strasbourg, and if there is, then the domestic cause should follow what Strasbourg is doing. So that's basically principle number two. And then number three is a Latin phrase, restitutio in integrum, which is essentially the applicant has to be put back in the position they would have been in if there had been no unlawful action. So there's your there are the three starting points. When it comes into the details of these cases, they don't really help very much. But that's what so often is said at the start of the cases, before really going into a sort of a different approach to damages and a more nuanced approach to damages. The starting point, I think, and a positive point, one reason to start here, is the case of Infinis. And that's the one I was talking about earlier, about these renewable obligation certificates. So we've covered already, there was a finding of an interference in Infinis because of the decision not to award a certificate. It's worth looking at the facts of it. Infinis was a case where there was a really complicated contract between the company and the state, and the state just didn't understand it. They obviously got it wrong, but they probably got it wrong because they didn't have enough resources to do so, or they'd employed people who weren't competent to do it. But you can imagine that happening more and more, and especially as the imbalance of resources between these big companies trying to get contracts and the much smaller resourced state bodies, you can see this sort of imbalance happening more and more. Anyway, the basic problem, the state just got it wrong, it was obviously wrong, and they just misunderstood the contract. Anyway, there was an interference here with Article 1, and so then the courts came on to decide what damages should be awarded. And the reason this is a positive case and a good starting point is the courts essentially awarded all of the damages that the company claimed. It was very specific, and it was quite a high amount of damages. Damages claimed were so these renewable obligation certificate, you get the certificate, you produce your energy after getting the certificate, and for each megawatt hour you're given a subsidy, and at the time it was about £50. And by the time the case came to court, in at least some of the claims, so there are a number of claims, but at least some of them, it was very clear exactly what loss had been sustained. So firstly, it was clear that if the state had acted lawfully, then they would have got this certificate and would have got the subsidy. And it was secondly clear because they knew exactly how many megawatt hours they had produced, and therefore exactly how many £50 they should have got. And in those circumstances, where the court found it was clear what the loss was, and it was readily calculable, in those circumstances, that an award of damages for exactly the loss was made. Now, as we look through a couple more of the cases, you'll see the real contrast between that and some of the other claims that have been made, and the different results that happen because of the contrast. If there were three words that you had to take away from this seminar, they would be clear and precise. In that, if your damages are clear and precise, you're fine. You should get them. If they're anything less than that, so if there's any uncertainty in the award of damages, future profit that you might or might not have got, anything like that, you're on really shaky grounds. You can still claim damages, but at best, probably, they'll be much, much less. And so to see a couple of examples of that, I hope it helps just giving examples of a couple of cases to illustrate the principles that have been applied here. The first one of them is called East-West Alliance Limited and Ukraine. And in these cases, I was hoping to have pictures here because all of these ones are sort of involving basically dramatically bad trading conditions, where this one involved an Irish company going to Ukraine to sell aeroplanes, those sort of 12-seater propeller-driven aeroplanes, and to try and lease them out in Ukraine. And there are all sorts of dramatic pictures of aeroplane crashes and things like that I'm going to put up. Unfortunately, they're not here to crash. You can just pretend that they're up there. And so the Ukrainian authorities seized 14 aeroplanes from this Irish company in about 2000. Then they either sold off some of the aeroplanes to other companies, or they just left them outside to rot, effectively. And they gave some of the aeroplanes eventually, after about 10 years back, they gave them back. the original company, East West Alliance. But by that time, they were effectively scrapped. So the company had gone from a position of having 14 very nice airplanes to having nothing, effectively. And they made a claim for breach of A1B1. And the court decided that this was a breach. But it's important, really, to look at the exact details of it. Some of the reasons for the... There are a lot of reasons for the breach, and it is actually worth reading the case. It's one of the easiest read-throughs of the principles that are being applied. But some of the reasons for there being a breach was as follows. The Ukrainian authorities firstly went into the company's headquarters and took away the certificates which showed the company owned the planes. They then went up to determine what they should do with these planes that they held and said, well, we need the owner here. If the owner's here, we will give the planes back to the owner, effectively, and sort of looked around. And no one came up with ownership certificates. That's because they were holding them behind their back on hand. And so they said, right, okay, we'll keep the planes then. So then they kept the planes. And so one of the key reasons for there being a violation was the court found it was arbitrary. So that, you know, on the one hand, taking away the certificate showing ownership, and on the other hand, saying you have to prove you're the owner. You know, again, I was trying to emphasise the need to try and look at any inconsistency or arbitrariness in the treatment of the authorities. That was really the strongest reason for finding a breach. When it came to damages, though, and this case is really the most important aspect of this case, is the damages aspect of it, because it's the longest exposition of the principles that are applied in this context of any case. The East West Alliance claimed $166 million for the price of all these planes. Doesn't seem too unreasonable to me. I've never bought one myself, but doesn't seem too bad. And they were given 5 million euros at the end of it, which is a lot less. And it's a lot less than those planes were probably even worth back in 2000. And the reason they did that was as follows. It's worth looking at the principles they apply. The first thing that they say is, it's essential when awarding damages to look at the difference between what is lawful action and what is unlawful action. In Infinis, it was really clear that if the state had acted lawfully, the company would have got those certificates and those £50 for each megawatt hour, and by acting unlawfully, the company didn't. The difference between them was very clear. But in East West Alliance, the difference actually between the lawful and unlawful action was much, much less clear. So if there was a dispute where one of East West Alliance's trading partners and someone who was in a consortium with East West Alliance had been brought before the criminal courts, and the courts were saying, well, we need the planes in order to determine this dispute. And had the country gone through a lawful process, so had there been no arbitrariness, had they not gone through a flawed procedure and so on, it still wasn't completely clear that East West Alliance would have had the plans. It might have been that the courts would have held them for 2 years in order to determine the dispute. It might have been something else would have happened. Anyway, that was quite an important factor in making it much more difficult to show what the difference was between East West Alliance not having the plans, unlawful action, and what would have happened if the state had acted lawfully. So that's the first factor that's important. The second one was about being able to precisely calculate the loss. This is a lesson. This is a good lesson. East West Alliance come along and say, here are some bills. They produce some very nice evidence showing the bills for what the planes would have cost if they were new. But the planes weren't new. When they were taken away, the planes were, I think, at least 10 years old and, you know, done lots of flying. But what the court didn't do in that situation would say, okay, we'll halve the difference, or we will come to a decision as to how much they were probably worth with the difference between when they're new and then that time. What the court said was that because we've rejected the evidence that you put forward, and so we simply can't have any uncertainty as to the loss. And because of that, we're going to make awards, and these are the dreaded words, on an equitable basis. And I'm sure, as you know from other contexts, an equitable basis is essentially... there's a purpose behind it, there's a reason for it, but it's essentially unprincipled. It's the court's impression of what's right. And in this context, it is generally much, much lower than what you think the actual loss is going to be. essentially the lesson from this case is, again, as perhaps was emphasised in Impinus, but if you don't have clear and precise evidence to show what your loss was, or if your evidence is rejected by the court, then you're on really shaky grounds. What the court said in that context was, if one or more heads of damage cannot be calculated precisely, the court may decide to make a global assessment ruling on an equitable basis. There are a couple of other interesting aspects about the case. So one of them was that the courts looked at the damages and they said, in this context, you're not just restricted to looking at financial loss. The damages that are available extend to a number of other heads. So they include things that might be predictable, loss of reputation, disruption to management, uncertainty in the operation of the business. But they also include things like distress, feelings of helplessness of the managers as they are waiting for their plans to come back. Might be a little bit more unexpected in this context than perhaps in someone who is in prison wrongly or distress suffered by a breach of Article 3, but those sort of things can be compensated here. Seems useful, but in reality the amount of money that you're going to get from that is very limited, and companies who are probably taking cases largely for financial reasons probably wouldn't justify doing so just for that reason. There was an even bigger gulf of damages between the amount claimed and the award given in the next case, so it's Centro Europa 7. This would have been even better on the screen here, because it was this is a television station from Italy, and it has these great logos on it that are really dramatic, and they're tied in with sorts of football deals. So if you can imagine exciting pictures of football players here to help you remember the game. This was a case involving a television company. And again, it's a licensing case. Quite a lot of the cases in this area are licensing cases, both in England and also in the European court. This was about a TV license. So Centro Europa 7 had been granted a license to operate in the Italian market. But although the original grant of it, the expectation would have been that they would be able to start operating within about 12 months. Then the authorities, and I think Berlusconi was in at the time, so it may not be predictable, and this was a competitor to Berlusconi, so that might be something to do with it, although I wouldn't want to cast any aspersions. The bandwidth that was necessary for them to be able to actually produce programmes and broadcast programmes wasn't allocated to them for 10 years. And this wasn't just a tiny company, this was a big broadcaster. It was a new type of venture for them, but it was a big broadcaster. And they produced loads of evidence to show that they'd suffered all sorts of losses because of this. You know, they've got studios and all sorts of facilities and costs to produce this TV network. And so they produced all this evidence, and they said, we've lost 2.175 billion euros or something like that. And the court said, that's very sad, but we're going to award you 10 million euros for it. And the reasons for that are similar to the East West Alliance case. It's essentially you don't have enough clear and consistent evidence for it. So the reasons were, again, the company hadn't showed all of the costs that it had brought receipts for were necessary for it to operate under the license. One of the key points, actually, which is useful to remember, is that the court also emphasised that the court sort of suggested, it didn't say this explicitly, but it suggested what we're all thinking. Essentially, these are private companies trying to make money. The courts are going to be less sympathetic of that, given that this is essentially risk-taking business anyway, than economic loss in some other contexts, you know, loss of economic opportunity or medical expenses if someone has been subjected to a breach of Article 3. So the court sort of touched upon that, saying that it's a risky area, and that's a reason why, if you don't have clear evidence to show the profits that you've lost, we're not going to reward them. And the court said this, where a loss of earnings is alleged, it must be conclusively established and must not be based on mere conjecture or probability. So it seems that, although if you came to a domestic court and read the of loss. Normally, the test is a civil test, the balance of probabilities. This would suggest there's some higher test to it. Now, whether that's appropriate in the domestic courts rather than the European courts is an issue for debate, but the main lesson, you know, the more detailed decision you can get in evidence, the better. I'm going to skip over the next few paragraphs because it's a sort of slightly dry debate about the causative link, exactly what the causative link will be. But for present purposes, given it's causative for and after, then just remember that there's a bit of a debate about it, and you know, we're probably going to have quite a few more cases determining exactly what it's going to be. Okay, the next point is about procedural breaches, generally, and hopefully I can subsume in 1 minute a complete description of not only procedural breaches in this context, but also the whole of Article 6 as it applies to companies. Article 6, as I'm sure you're aware, requires some basic procedural protections when there is a determination of a civil right. And a determination of a civil right includes an economic right. So whether you're entitled to a particular fee or, again, a license or regulatory decisions, things like that, that can and often does amount to a determination of a civil right. And there will therefore be basic procedural requirements of fairness or access to courts, depending on the context. However, both in terms of procedural breaches of Article 6 and also procedural breaches of A1 P1, the damages that are available are very low. So the court's essential approach is what we've already been discussing. Unless you can show that there's a real difference in the loss that you would have sustained between lawful and unlawful activity, then you're not going to get anywhere. And with a procedural breach, unless it inevitably flows, unless the loss clearly and precisely flows from that breach, then you're probably not going to get any more than, you know, the very small €10,000 or that sort of type of thing. Expert evidence, I hope I've already emphasised the kind of importance of this. And this type of claim, expert evidence, can be absolutely key for damages, but it can also be key for liability. And an example may help in this to explain this, which is of licences. I hope at the start I began to explain some of the complexities involved in whether a licence is a possession. But one of the key tests is whether holding that licence, so do you remember the restaurant with the liquor licence? One of the key tests is whether holding that licence increases the marketable value of the company that has it. So if you're going to sell the company, is the price a bit higher because you've got the licence than it would be otherwise? And again, you need precision. And you also need expert evidence. And there have been loads of cases involving this in the context of UKBL. So the border agency, the licences that they give to colleges. I'm not sure if you're aware of this area, but a private college can apply for a licence from the UKBA to enable it to sponsor foreign students who can then come and study courses in the UK. And there have been a lot of quite high-profile examples of colleges that have been closed down because the UKBA didn't think that they were operating properly, but they were operating within this incredibly complex list of guidelines that they have. So there have been loads of cases by these annoyed colleges. That's in part because there have been quite a few colleges who didn't really know what they were doing in it, but it's also in part because the UKBA don't really know what they're doing about this. Everything's too complicated. And as yet, none of those companies have managed to get damages. Quite a few of them have shown that the action is unlawful. And there are two reasons why the companies haven't yet got damages. The first one is they didn't use expert evidence. And so there's a case on the notes called New London Colleges where the court said the court doesn't completely close the door to damages being awarded in this context, but it says you have to produce evidence. You didn't. It wasn't concrete enough. So you're not going to get any money. So that's the first reason that they haven't got damages. No evidence. The second reason is that they just haven't come to court yet. So there are loads and loads of these cases waiting. I think some of the hearings are starting in June this year, or they hope to, which will begin to give much more consideration to this issue where you can have damages. So if this is something that interests you, then keep an eye out for those cases. Okay, we've only got a couple of minutes more. There are a few other notes there are a few other comments in the notes that might be of interest, but perhaps it's best if I just stop there and ask if anyone has any questions.
Is goodwill possession?
Is goodwill possession?
Well,
yeah, that it is, but only as defined in the case law. Goodwill in accountancy practice in England has a particular meaning, and it has a different meaning in the European case law. So the meaning in the European case law really is the same as what I've talked about with licences, an increase in the capitalised value of the business.
God, so, how would you quantify it? It's really hard, isn't it?
Really difficult. Some tips, though, are try and get... firstly, you can try and get an accountant who will say, yes, in my opinion, in my expert opinion, with all of this, all of these years of experience that I have, this does increase the goodwill. But that's probably not going to be enough. You probably have to have objective evidence for that as well. And the objective evidence could be examples from analogous cases. So if you can look at other companies that have been sold with a licence or without it, in a lot of contexts you're not going to be able to find that, but if you can find that, that's a really good starting point.
If you think of something with hope value, take a piece of land, that's tangible, but the land itself has development potential. It may have planning consent, it may not, but it may be a chance of getting planning consent depending on what the development plan says. How do you approach that, even assuming you could find the right case where this is relevant, but that it might be one to ever get a case against an authority where a land issue is involved?
Yeah, the best case for that is one called Pine Valley Investments, which is quite an old one now, and it's about whether planning permission amounts to possession. Again, it's this odd line between legitimate expectation and loss of future income. What they decided there was that there had been a legal act which granted planning permission. And because of that, even though the economic benefit that was being talked about was the potential to, you know, get money from the house once it had been built in future, because there had been this legal act which granted the planning permission, then that amounted to a possession. But the key word's a legal act, because if there's been none of that, if there's been no judgment by court, and it's just a hope that you will get extra money from it, then that's not sufficient. I find it quite difficult to understand the distinction between the two, but that's what they say.
So I remember in Auchinbury, it was accepted effectively that it was right for the, and it was all companies in Auchinbury, it was right for them to take proceedings based on Article 6 or potential breaches, which in the end they decided there were no breaches. But I don't remember there being an issue that what they were arguing over were planning consents which were yet to be issued, because none of the parties had got their planning consent yet. They were being called in at least two of the cases, etc., so they hadn't yet made a decision.
I mean, if there's an actual interference with the land that they've already got without, so the planning consent can be left aside, again, like the nuisance cases, the sewage water coming on the land and that sort of thing, then that could be an interference itself, regardless of the planning consent. I haven't read Auchinbury recently. It may be just that they didn't argue the issue. I mean, it's quite interesting in this context that there's a gap between the approach of the domestic courts and the European courts, and there's also inconsistencies between the cases, especially in the domestic courts, because people don't seem to raise the points that they could do. So you sometimes have to have a bit of caution with the case law.
I was just thinking about that question of what the standard of proof is on proving a lot pecuniary loss. I mean, looking at this for the other session on damages earlier today, I thought that the analysis was that if you can show on the balance of probabilities a pecuniary loss and it's readily calculable, which is the phrase used in Infinis, then you will get the whole of your loss. But if you can't do that, there is this fallback that the court will apply in a sort of just what's equitable, the equitable assessment. And so even if you can't prove on the balance of probabilities that the loss was even caused by the unlawful act, you can still get an award. So I would argue that it's not a higher test. What it is that it has this residual power to provide an award of damages if you can't meet the balance of probabilities threshold, but it's inevitably going to be a very low award because it's done on this global assessment basis and it's pegged to Strasbourg levels rather than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a lot of arguments in favour of that. One of them is INFINIS, which seems to support that approach. And there's other, there are European cases which use the phrase loss of opportunity. So as long as you can show you had a loss of opportunity, then you will be able to get damages on an equitable basis. Yeah. But there are also arguments the other way. And so there's the case that we saw earlier with the bank where the phrase you have to have certainty and probability isn't enough. And the approach of some of the cases, some of the courts in those cases as well, seems to imply a stricter approach than simply balance of probability. But again, one of the interesting aspects of these is the European Court sees itself as subsidiary, and so it may be because of that approach, in these cases where it says that actually assessment of lawfulness, of substantive lawfulness, if it's a matter for the national courts, then we're not going to interfere with this unless we're certain. And so that subsidiary nature might explain why there's a difference between our approach and theirs.
But it wouldn't explain Z and the UK or E and the UK, for example.
No, because so in Z they say there has to be a direct causal link, which seems to indicate that support for your approach.
I don't know. I mean, I mean, you're right. INFINIS, it does appear to be the Court of Appeal took the stance that this can be calculated. There is on the balance of probabilities this loss was caused, so you can have all of it. So that, so as long as you reach that threshold, then you'll get everything. And presumably the same would apply in Strasbourg. And one of the cases I mentioned earlier, which is a loss of earnings case arising from Article 2, where the Strasbourg court applied the Ogden tables in assessing a bereavement award, a dependency award for the family of the deceased, and they reached applied it in exactly the same way that a domestic court would do, and it was a very very high award, which again suggests that if you can prove it on a financial pecuniary loss to the balance of probabilities, you will get everything. And it's only when you can't reach that threshold it suddenly drops to this very small kind of residual award.
Yeah, I think it's probably a matter open for debate that we're going to need to see some more cases to clarify completely. But
could I ask why does the license have to be transferable in order for there to be an interference with it?
It's this. It appears to me, from what I can see, that the cases at some point have said, for one reason or another, loss of income isn't enough. And then they've had a license case, and they've sort of developed these two strands of case law where loss of income isn't enough, but licenses can be involved. And then they've come together and thought, what are we going to do about this? We're going to have some principles to divide the line between them. The test is that if the license is transferable, normally that will be a possession. It's something that's an economic benefit that you can sell or has marketable value, and it's not merely a sort of hope for future benefit from it. If it's not transferable, that still can be a possession, but again, you have to show that it increases your business's value as a whole. And if you can't prove that, then I think the courts have really just resorted to, we don't want to be involved in things that are just a matter of hope or expectation.
So is it an alternative then? Either the license is transferable, or there is the expert evidence to show the impact upon the business. You don't have to demonstrate both limits in order to.
It's a bit difficult because all the cases I can think of where the license has been transferable, it also has given the business marketable value, and it's quite difficult to see when that wouldn't be the case. So probably the marketable value test is the joining applies to both of them.